Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. Steve Kraske is away this week. I'm Brian Ellison. Imagine sports without athletes. Far-fetched? Well, maybe, but as computers and statistical analysis progresses, our ability to predict outcomes changes, our ability to recreate live action on a screen advances, maybe it isn't out of the question that Super Bowl LXXVII won't involve hamstring pulls or grass stains. Joining us to talk about that and all manner of math madness is Sam Arbusman. He's an applied mathematician and network scientist and a senior scholar for research and policy at the Kauffman Foundation. Welcome back to Up to Date, Sam.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
We have lots to talk about today, including the differences between luck and skill and the many spellings of Hanukkah. But first, let's start with sports. You actually proposed this in a column for Wired, an online column for Wired magazine. What gets you thinking about the possibility of sports without real athletes?
Well, so I first began thinking this when a magazine called ARC contacted me and said, complete the sentence, in the future, dot, dot, dot. And so I said, somewhat flippantly, in the future, we'll be following the compelling story arcs of computer-simulated sporting events. And so I thought that was kind of a fun little thing. And then I began realizing that maybe there's more to this, and maybe there's the possibility for a certain thought experiment, because it turns out that, and even though we love the idea of the human within sports, and sports bring out many, many aspects of what is most human, the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat, people overcoming the odds, all these different things. It turns out that in many ways, sports can be computerized and quantified. And perhaps in some ways, that's the kind of things that people care about. So, for example, we've gotten to the point where computer graphics can simulate sports very, very well. We've gotten to the point where mathematics can actually predict sports exceedingly accurately.
Right. I mean, this is what video games about sports, Madden, football, or that's what they do, right? They take statistics and they predict likelihood of things happening, right?
Right, yeah. So computer games will actually – and computer games will provide in sort of an actual real-world environment the instantiation of a lot of these statistics. And in fact, actually, I believe of the past 10 or so Super Bowls, when – the people who created the Madden NFL franchise played those Super Bowls before they happened. Most of the time, they were actually successful in predicting the winner, the eventual victor. So it seems as if a lot of these games and a lot of the statistics are accurate, and they can actually provide us with a sense of verisimilitude. But at the same time, though, of course, for a lot of people, and for some people, the statistics are all that people care about when it comes to sports. Mm-hmm. So many people, when they go to baseball games, they're filling out the card and actually trying to figure out, okay, who's doing this?
I'm one of those people, so I'm just going to admit.
Yeah, so there you go. So there's many people who are reducing real games already to the numbers.
Right.
So to a certain degree, why don't we just cut out the middleman and make it all about numbers? But of course, I mean, that might not be enough for everyone. We can also actually simulate things with visual appearance as well.
Right, but isn't part of the appeal of sports the sweat, the digging down deep, the human element that you know is happening in the minds and the hearts of the players on the field?
It could be. Although then again, if you look at fictional representations of sports, so sports teams in TV shows or in movies or in books, people care about them very, very deeply, and they're by no means real. And so it turns out we can care about these things without them actually having real people, as long as the stories are compelling enough to us.
So there's, you wrote about an example of this where when the NBA season looked like it might not happen, when the lockout was going on, there was sort of an attempt to recreate the whole experience, right?
Yeah. So so Bill Simmons and J. Caspian King, they're both sports writers for Grantland. They, during the NBA lockout, they decided that they had enough. They were going to actually just, over the course of a discussion, actually tried to build a whole new league in their minds and actually populate it with players, figure out which cities would be best, name the teams. And then they decided they'd already done that. Let's actually play out the entire season in their own minds. And so they did this. And when I read this essay, it was one of the most interesting essays I'd read in a while. But of course, none of it was real. It was really, really interesting. But then it got even better. It turns out people who read this essay decided to actually make fictional and virtual versions of the jerseys for the teams that didn't actually exist. So, for example, Kansas City actually has an NBA team in this fictional version called the Kansas City Klondike Bars. And people made jerseys for them.
Wow.
Even though they don't exist.
Well, it's something to look forward to. Something for the Sprint Center, finally.
Yeah. Perhaps,
okay.
Yes.
Very good. So I mean, you're sort of saying some of these things tongue in cheek here, Sam. But I mean, how much of this do you think really could happen? I mean, are things moving this direction, you think?
It's not entirely clear. I mean, I would say I highly doubt that actual physical sports with real people are ever going to go by the wayside. I imagine this kind of thing might eventually coexist with real sports. But in addition to it just being cheaper, it turns out there's actually a lot of upside for this. So, for example, in a lot of sports, especially football, people can get injured very, very badly and sustain head traumas and blow out their knees, all these different things.
Right.
In virtual worlds, this doesn't happen. You can have people doing crazy things and they'll get up and play again because you just restart the simulation. But in addition, you can actually simulate exciting situations that you would never be able to do in the real world. So, for example, put a teen wolf on an NBA team. That's the kind of thing that you could actually have in the real world, but you could have it in a simulated sports team.
And I'm sure that would be very exciting.
I hope so.
So I did enjoy sort of the idea that what people are really most excited about when they watch sports are the outcomes. And so what changes in this is really the payoff isn't any different in this scenario.
Right. You'd still have the outcomes. And so certainly if people are interested in gambling and that's all they care about, you could still have that. But you could still also actually see the games themselves if you wanted to actually simulate it with a really complicated computer simulation with very, very sophisticated graphics or anything like that.
We're talking today with Sam Arbisman, who is a senior scholar for research and policy at the Kauffman Foundation. He's a mathematician and a network scientist. He's also the author of the book, The Half-Life of Facts, Why Everything We Know Has an Expiration Date. He's an author himself. He's also an appreciator of good books that bring out truths or interesting things about math and science. And we've asked him, with the holidays coming up, to name a couple of books that our listeners might be interested in. I'll go ahead and name Sam's book, which I found fascinating when you talked about that on the air here a couple months ago on Up to Date.
Well, thank you very much. So some other books. So the first one I'd like to mention is called The Joy of X, A Guided Tour of Math from 1 to Infinity. It's written by Stephen Sturgatz, who happens to be my graduate school advisor. So that might seem I'm a little biased, but
it's okay. You've disclosed it.
Yes. The book is amazing. It actually is based on a series of columns that Steve Sturgatz did several years ago for the New York Times Online, where he realized that there's a great deal of beauty and wonder within mathematics, but a lot of people who are not mathematicians don't know about that. And so for a lot of people, when they hear the word math or any words associated with math, their brains shut down and they become afraid to a certain degree. But he realized that a lot of mathematics is actually actually quite elegant and not terribly complicated, and there needs to be a greater joy and awareness of mathematics in the broader population. And so he began writing these essays, beginning with what is a number, to how do prime numbers work, all the way up to more esoteric things like chaos or fractals or game theory. But he provides an explanation in the columns, as well as in the book, geared towards a lay audience. And it turns out when he wrote these columns, there was an enormous response. It turns out he was tapping into this need for understanding mathematics for the lay person that no one had really addressed. So he began writing this book, and it deals with everything from how you can use equations to understand love, to really every aspect of human and mathematical endeavor.
Now you asked Steve in an interview you did with him that I read about the first time that he realized he loved math, and I wonder if you could sort of share his answer to that question. I'm also interested in your answer to that question. When did you first know? Was there a moment where the light flashed on and you realized math was what it was all about?
Well, for Steve, his first moment was when he was in science class in high school, and he was learning about the pendulum. And so you have a pendulum where you have a thread and then a ball at the bottom, and then you can swing it back and forth. And their job was to measure the period of a pendulum, how long it takes to go back and forth. And he began measuring this, and he realized that even as the swings kind of mm-hmm. became closer and closer, and he began to change the length of the pendulum. He realized and began measuring the period versus the length of the pendulum, the length of the string, and began plotting it on a simple piece of graph paper. He realized that a simple mathematical equation emerged, in this case, a parabola. And he realized this was unbelievable. It was a simple object in the real world that was doing mathematics. And he realized that algebra and mathematics is all around us, that that mathematics is embodied in our physical world. And this was just a mind-blowing experience to him and began his exploration of mathematics.
Right. It said that he noticed that the shape that the graph made was the same shape as the water coming out of the water fountain in the
– Right. Yeah. So there's this idea that there are simple equations that can unify so many different things around us, and that's unbelievably exciting.
Yeah. Did you have an experience like that, Sam, where you remember sort of this was the moment where math started to make sense and intrigued you?
I'm not sure if I had a single moment where math began to intrigue me. I would say
Were you a kid when this started to be
important? I was certainly always interested in mathematics. And it was always very, very exciting to see. I would say I can't think of a childhood experience. I do know that every now and then, and you get this childlike wonder at seeing mathematics. So, for example, one simple way to kind of recapture this wonder is actually one of the things in The Joy of X that I had not realized, but I might have learned it a while back, but I don't recall, was how to calculate the value of pi using pretty much a whole bunch of successively circle-shaped objects.
So you pecan pie or pumpkin pie.
No, sorry, the mathematical constant pi,
oh,
which
is
3.14.
Right.
And so you can use a hexagon and an octagon, and then you keep on making a shape with more and more sides. And it turns out by doing this in a very, very simple way and just kind of reshaping the wedges within these sort of pi-like or circle-like shapes, you can very, very easily calculate pi. And it turns out you can do this with child toys, like simple toys, and you can actually calculate one of these – the numbers that underlie a great deal of what we see in the world. And that's the kind of thing that when it hits you, it's unbelievable to see.
Right. So a lot of the Joy of X seems to be about the beauty and the elegance of math. What do you think is the most – or can you give us another example of something that is just incredibly elegant out of mathematics?
So incredibly elegant. So one thing, perhaps this is not elegant. It's almost the opposite, where you have a very simple equation that can yield a great deal of complexity, is something – it's known as the Mandelbrot set, where you write this simple equation. Has about four or five terms, including one and plus. It's very, very simple. And it turns out it describes a picture. But it turns out this picture, it looks kind of psychedelic and colorful. But if you zoom into this picture, it turns out there's no end to the complexity. It's a self-similar object that is incredibly complicated and beautiful. And you can explore it. You can blow it up to the size of the Earth or the galaxy. And there is still complexity that you've never realized. And this embodies objects known as fractals. And I think the Mandelbrot set is the most well-known example of that. And I think there's a certain elegance in the fact that this one tiny little equation can essentially explain an entire universe of complexity, in this case within a simple object.
So there's another book that you've mentioned, a book that tries to make the distinction between skill and luck and show how they're related to each other, right?
Yeah, so this is a book by Michael Mobison, who also happens to be a friend of mine. The book is called The Success Equation, Untangling Skill and Luck in Business, Sports, and Investing. And Mobison begins from the idea of what is luck and what is skill. And we all sort of know intuitively the extremes. Luck is gambling, like playing maybe a roulette wheel. And skill is chess, the other extreme. But what about everything in between? So, for example, sports. Are there some sports that are more skillful or more lucky? And so Mobison begins by actually first defining the difference between luck and skill. And he uses dictionary definitions. But actually, one good rule of thumb is how do you distinguish between luck and skill? Well, if it's a game or something like that, if you can lose on purpose, there's probably an element of skill. If you can't lose on purpose, it's probably all luck. So I can't lose on purpose with a roulette wheel. I also can't win on purpose with a roulette wheel. That's all luck. The more trouble you have losing on purpose, the more likely there is skill involved. And so Mobison begins by actually – so he takes this idea and as well as numerous other ideas and begins to figure out how to actually mathematically – and for a lay audience, mathematically understand the difference between luck and skill and which games are more skillful and which ones are more lucky. How does skill play a role in investing? So are a lot of people simply being lucky? So for example, if a mutual fund manager – beats the market 20 years in a row, is that just luck or is that exemplary skill? And it turns out there are actually ways of understanding this. You can actually use these performance streaks to actually use them as a marker to tease apart the difference between luck and skill. And so he examines all these different examples to try to see how luck and skill play a role in our everyday lives.
So let's talk about some of the sports, for example. So basketball is considered luckier than or more skillful than baseball. Why would something like that be? What makes a sport lucky? What makes a sport skill based?
Well, so there's a number of different factors, and it depends on sort of the level that you're looking at. So, for example, if you look at simply the number of games, the more games you're playing, the more chance you have of actually teasing out which teams are better than others.
Right. But so a football season of 16 games is going to be more subject to luck. One pass caught in an end zone determines a big portion of your season versus 162 games in baseball.
Right. Things like that. But it turns out that also if you look at the number of players and how play is distributed among them. So, for example, in baseball, most of the time everyone needs to hit. And so if there's any variance between players, that will come across in a baseball game. On the other hand, though, in hockey or in basketball, you can often allow the best players to have more play time and actually handle winning more often. And so one of the other things he also does, though, is he said – and so the way to – and you can look at the details of each game, but you can also abstract it. And you can say, okay, let's assume it's all luck. What would a season look like? And so it would just be sort of this like a weighted coin being flipped over and over. And it turns out the games that have more luck, they often look very, very similar to it just being chosen by a simple coin flip. On the other hand, though, when there actually is skill involved, so for example of basketball, then there actually is a much more flat distribution. So it doesn't look like a simple like bell curve or normal distribution. Hmm. It actually seems as if the good teams, they win more consistently. And there is actually a meaning to the term good team as opposed to simply just being a lucky team.
Right. Now, you mentioned that he also writes about business and investing too. I wonder, I mean, what does this analysis teach us about how we might better invest our money? I mean, what does that tell us?
Well, so first of all, and one of the ideas that permeates his entire book is this idea of the reversion to the mean. So if you're lucky, but you think you're skillful, chances are – and so if you're beating the odds, beating the market, next year, simply due to luck and due to this idea of a reversion to the mean, you're going to be closer to the way everyone else is performing. And so there's a certain awareness that you need to recognize that oftentimes what people ascribe to skill is often luck. And there's this idea of a reversion to the mean. On the other hand, conversely, if you do more poorly one year, and let's say last year, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to do more poorly again. Oftentimes, though, people forget this. And if they're doing very well, they double down. Or if they're doing very poorly, they get out. But there is this idea of reversion to the mean, especially when you're looking at the entire market. And so you have to recognize that, especially if you're investing in index funds and things like that, you should just keep on investing at a fairly steady rate in order to benefit from this idea of reversion to the mean. Because chances are you probably can't beat the market. And so therefore, you have to take advantage of ways of not making sure you're constantly losing to the market, which in this case is when things are going poorly, getting out, because it turns out things do get better simply due to the reversion of the mean, not due to any skill of yourself.
Listening to Up to Date on KCUR, I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking with Sam Arbesman about math, the joy of X, and all sorts of math madness. We're getting close to the holidays, Sam, and we've got a few topics that I think relate to the holidays, not the least of which is the many ways to spell Hanukkah.
Yeah, it turns out there's many, many different ways of spelling Hanukkah. You can have a CH at the beginning. You can have just an H at the beginning. You have two Ks, one K. There's really a very wide number of
spellings. And you're going to tell us what's the right way to spell Hanukkah.
Well, I won't necessarily tell you the exact right way. I will tell you a way to embody all of them, a way to unify them. And it turns out it actually comes from theoretical computer science.
Well, of course it does.
Of course. Everything goes down to math.
Right. We assume that.
Yes. So it turns out there's something known as – they're called regular expressions. Some of you may know about these. For those of you who don't, a regular expression is simply it's a little string of characters that is sort of like a miniature programming language, where the idea is that if you want to capture a lot of similar looking text. So, for example, let's say I want to get every time I want to search for every two numbers that are next to each other. Turns out I can't just say – I can either list out every possible two-digit number, which is exhausting, or I can actually write a simple regular expression to embody that. But it turns out regular expressions can be used for lots more complicated things. And in this case, they can actually be used – you can write a simple little script to actually capture every single way to spell Hanukkah.
And when you say a script, you're saying a little bit of a string of
– it's a little string.
Letters and numbers that the computer understands – for making this calculation.
Right. Yeah. So a computer will then be able to – so you can write this little string and then a computer can then find every single instance of Hanukkah.
No matter how it's spelled.
Yes. Agnostic to how it's spelled, how many Ks you put in there, all these different kinds of things. So for example, the way I don't know if you want me to read this. It's probably not quite human readable.
Oh, well, we definitely need to hear. What is the expression that captures all of the spellings of Hanukkah?
So, well, of course, it's going to be quite elegant.
Yes.
It is. So first you have a bracket. Then you have capital C, capital H, capital K. Then another bracket. Then H, question mark. A-N-N, question mark, bracket. A-E-I-U, bracket. K-K, question mark. A-H, question mark. And of course, it's obvious that that spells Hanukkah.
I'm a little concerned about how it's going to fit on the greeting cards, but I'm sure Hallmark is working.
Right. Yeah, that's beyond my pay grade.
Someone else's problem. You know, speaking of holidays, you've been reflecting a little bit on the way that dates are assigned to holidays and the sort of this this rain. Some days are very simple, like the 4th of July. Almost always happens on the 4th of July. But there's other dates that are more difficult to calculate, and the implications that has from a math standpoint are sort of interesting.
Right. Yeah. So I was thinking about this back when Thanksgiving happened, because Thanksgiving, and it's characterized as the fourth Thursday in November, which is a little bit more complex than July 4th or New Year's Day, but it's not that complicated. And so I began to think about what is the complexity of describing when a date occurs. And it turns out thinking about the complexity of describing something is not new. There's actually a term for this. It's called Kolmogorov complexity, which is the way to describe – it's the complexity of description of something. So for example, let's say I have a text that's nothing but 100 ones in a row. Turns out I can reduce that to simply saying type 1 100 times in a row. So it has a very low Kolmogorov complexity because I can reduce it. I can compress it. On the other hand, if I have a string of random digits, there's a great deal of complexity in that. It turns out you can do a similar kind of thing with the dates. You can actually look at their description of when the dates occur of these various holidays and see which ones have higher complexity or lower complexity. And it turns out probably the highest complexity ones are religious holidays. So they're often tied to the lunar calendar. It's a combination of the lunar calendar and the solar calendar, or the solstices or the equinoxes. Those things are very, very complicated.
So something like Easter, which is on the first Sunday after the first full moon after the vernal equinox.
Yeah, that would be really complicated.
Right.
Similarly, if you look at when the date of Passover is going to, or when the first day of Passover is going to happen. It turns out someone actually wrote an equation for this. It is an exceedingly complicated, simple – it's one equation, but it's a very, very complicated equation. On the other hand, though, if you go to federal holidays, things become a little bit simpler. So you have July 4th on the easy end, and on the most complicated end, you have like in the middle, you have things like Columbus Day, so the second Monday in November. The most complex is probably Inauguration Day, which is January 20th every fourth year following presidential elections. Unless that is, it falls on a Sunday, and then it's January 21st. So that's probably
will be the case in 2013.
There you go. So in this case, we're capturing all that complexity. So probably Inauguration Day is the most complex federal holiday. Election Day itself is also fairly complicated. It's the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. That's more complicated than Thanksgiving, little bit less complicated than Inauguration Day, far less complicated than Easter or Passover.
So in a word, why is this more important to be able to describe mathematically than to simply say it's the first – it's the 20th except in the, every year when it falls on a Sunday?
I don't know if it's more important. It's certainly more interesting, though.
Well, I think so, too. That's Sam Arbisman. He is the senior scholar for research and policy at the Kauffman Foundation. He's a mathematician and network scientist. Thanks so much for being back with us, Sam.
Thank you so much.